Hi everyone, Adam here, and last weekend I had the great opportunity to be the guest preacher at the First Congregational Church of Eugene in Eugene, Oregon. And if you're ever in Eugene, go check out the church. Fabulous people there, Jonathan and Janet and Melanie and Gretchen and all kinds of wonderful people there. Highly recommend going to see them. And this sermon that I preached was about racism. It's called Hemorrhaging Black Blood, What White America Can Do to Help Stop the Bleeding. So I explore racism and white privilege. And that's all alive in me because during the last couple of weeks, we've had the horrible shootings in Charleston and the fires at the black churches down in the South. And I wanted to bring a word of challenge and a word of hope to the church there, because we cannot in the North just say that racism exists in the South. Oregon has its own racist past that we need to own up to, and it affects the present. And you will see why as the sermon goes along. A few things before we start. There is an Albany, Oregon, which is near Corvallis, Oregon, which is where the Beavers play and go to school. So that's Oregon State, and there's a big rivalry between the Oregon State Beavers and the University of Oregon Ducks. Talk about that a little bit. And also at the pulpit at the First Congregational Church of Eugene are two buttons. And above one of those buttons, it says fire, and the other one above it says brimstone. And so there's fire and brimstone, and those buttons were very tempting to push, but I didn't. But that comes up at the beginning of the service. So with that, I hope you enjoy the sermon. Feel free to leave your comments below in the comment section. And yeah, peace be with you. When I was up here earlier getting myself fit for this, I noticed that there are two buttons up front. One is called fire and one is called brimstone. Do you know about this? I am feeling a sense of power right now and extreme curiosity as to what those do. Janet told me, unfortunately, that they do nothing, which is so disappointing. But also, I think appropriate, because we have been experiencing a lot of fire and brimstone in our culture lately, and we are discovering that God has nothing to do with it. All of that fire and brimstone is on us, and we need to take responsibility for it. And I couldn't help but talk about some of that fire and brimstone, and it's awkward. It's awkward inside of me, and I'm afraid that it's going to come out awkward in this sermon. And so, if you agree with what I have to say, that's great. If you don't agree, I will be in the back after worship, and you can come apologize to me then. Do you like that? That's good. Yeah. So let's get to it. I have a relative who lives in Albany. His church recently called a new pastor, and he was part of the search committee. When I asked him about his experience, he told me that they had one very important theological question that they asked every candidate. Indeed, it is one of the most important questions I've heard a church ask since moving to Oregon last year. A pastor's livelihood depends on this answer. In fact, a pastor's eternal soul hangs in the balance of this answer. That all-important question is, so are you a beaver or a duck? I know, mind-blowing, right? I mean, let's just get to the heart and soul of the issue here in Oregon. Did you guys put Jonathan through that question? Because since he isn't here, we can talk about him, right? I bet he's a beaver fan, which is a dangerous thing to be here in the heart of Eugene. I mean, have you ever stopped to think about the great divide that is the rivalry between the Ducks and the Beavers? It's called the Civil War. Apparently, the rivalry is so intense that we Oregonians had to name it after the worst conflict the United States has ever seen. In Washington, they call their rivalry the Apple Cup. Isn't that cute? You know, the rest of the country thinks we Oregonians are a bunch of laid-back hippies. No way, man.
We mean business. We have the Civil War. And I will not tell you which team my family roots for, because most of you might be deeply offended. But I will tell you that during worship services, my oldest son sits in the balcony and creates miniature art studio. During the sermons, he draws pictures, usually of beavers. Oh, that's upside down. There we go. Most of you would like that upside down. Okay. One of the interesting things about sports rivalries is that if you are a fan of one team in the rivalry, it means that you have to hate the other team. Sure, there are some lukewarm fans who root for whichever Oregon team is in the bowl game. But if you are a Duck fan, it means you hate the Beavers. And if you are a Beaver fan, you hate the Ducks. There is a divide, a line drawing in the sand. Either you are with us or you are against us. Now, my wife will tell you that my sports passions are a bit crazy and weird. And I will tell you that she is right. In fact, I will tell you that she is always right. Fortunately, sports rivalries are mostly harmless. Granted, there are times when hostility and violence break out at sporting events, but it's rare. Unfortunately, there are other divisions and rivalries that are much more harmful in our culture because they create in us an identity of hostility over and against the other side. This hostile identity creates a divide between us and them. It tells us who is included and who is excluded. Who is good and who is evil. This hostility threatens every aspect of the United States, including our political, religious, economic, and as we are painfully aware of during the last few weeks, racial divides. And this is why I love Jesus. He comes into the world and he tears down the hostile barriers that we've constructed that pit us against one another. And in place of that hostile identity, he builds a new identity within us that he calls the kingdom of God. That identity is not based on hostility against an enemy, but rather on an all-inclusive love. Jesus, the great Jewish rabbi, took the greatest commandment of his spiritual tradition and extended it. Not only shall you love your neighbor, our rabbi Jesus says, but if you plan to follow him, you will love even your enemies. And I'm the first to admit that that is really hard. But love is how Jesus tears down hostile divisions between us and them. Love is how Jesus reconstructs a new world, healing the world and ourselves with God's love. The good news is that we saw one barrier brought down this last week by God's love as the Supreme Court ruled in favor of marriage equality, breaking down barriers to marriage for our lesbian and gay sisters and brothers. And that divine love that breaks down barriers is on full display in our reading this morning. Jesus was walking with his disciples, and a crowd had gathered around him. A well-respected leader of the synagogue named Jairus came to Jesus and fell at his feet. He begged Jesus to heal his 12-year-old daughter, who was near death. Jesus agreed to help, but while he walked to Jairus' house, the crowd grew bigger and pressed in on him. We meet a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. This constant hemorrhaging made her a social outcast. People in her day avoided her. People in our day likely would avoid her too. To make her situation even worse, she spent all of her money on doctors who promised to heal her, but they never delivered on their promise. She was on the margins of her society. A divide had been created between her and everyone else. Her society had given up on her, but she hadn't given up on herself. She heard that a healer named Jesus was in town, and she fought her way through the crowd towards him. She thought, if I only touch his robe, I will be healed. Indeed, she touched his robe, and her bleeding stopped. Jesus sensed that power had gone forth from his body. He turned around and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" The story tells us that the woman came to Jesus in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. Jesus responded to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." In the meantime, as Jesus was delayed from Jairus' daughter by the elderly woman, some people from Jairus' house came and told him that his daughter had died. In the midst of this horrible news, Jesus looked Jairus in the eyes and said, "Do not fear, only believe. The child is not dead, but sleeping." After Jesus said that, the crowd laughed at him in disbelief. But Jesus paid no attention to the crowd. He knew his mission was to give life to those who were dead. Now, I don't know if Jesus literally brought the dead girl, back to life. I don't know if Jesus literally healed a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. But I do know that Jesus did something that was just as miraculous as a literal healing. Jesus does provide healing by deconstructing our rivalries and hostilities against one another. He deconstructs the ways we marginalize people. Rivalry, hostility, exclusion, and marginalization are the ways of death. And Jesus brings us an alternative way of life through God's all-inclusive love. How many of us here today need to hear those healing words of Jesus? How many of us are like the elderly woman who was bleeding and suffering for 12 years as a social outcast on the margins of society? How many of us are like the elderly leader of the synagogue whose loved one was on the verge of death and in desperation throws himself at Jesus' feet? How many of us need to hear the healing words Jesus spoke to the woman who was bleeding? "You are my daughter," or "You are my son. You are a loved and valued member of this community." How many of us need to hear the healing words Jesus gave Jairus' daughter? "Beloved little girl, it's okay. It's time to get up." On an individual level, I know that I need to hear those words of healing. And maybe you do too. But I also know that on a national level, the United States needs to hear those words of healings as well. Because on the same day that we celebrated the Supreme Court decision in favor of marriage equality, we also witnessed the funeral of Reverend Clementa Pinckney. It was an important reminder that in the midst of celebrating justice of marriage equality, we have so much work to do to heal the divide of racism that continues to infect the United States. The United States is like Jairus' daughter. We are sick and near death, and we need someone to wake us up from our sickness. The United States is like the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years and needing healing. I'm struck by the fact that the woman came to Jesus in fear and trembling and, quote, told him the whole truth. And that's when Jesus said she was made well of her disease. Telling the whole truth leads to healing, but it also leads to vulnerability. And who wants to be vulnerable? Because you never know if people will accept you and love you for who you are. The hemorrhaging woman took a risk. Jairus took a risk. And we need to take a risk. If the United States is going to heal from racism, then we need to be like the bleeding woman and tell the whole truth so that we might be healed of our disease. I, as a white man, need to tell the whole truth so that I can be healed. Because you see, the blood that the United States has been hemorrhaging since the foundation of our birth was largely the blood of African and Native Americans. The Black Bull blood that has been spilled in Charleston was spilled in Baltimore, was spilled in Ferguson, was spilled in Chicago, was spilled in Cleveland, and has been spilled in virtually every city in America since its founding. And thank God that Confederate flag is coming down throughout the South. You may have heard yesterday that Bree Newsom courageously stepped out of the crowd, risked climbing that flagpole in South Carolina, and brought down the flag that's been hemorrhaging hatred for years. But I wish I could tell you that that racism is a problem that exists only somewhere else. I wish I could tell you that here in the North, that here in Oregon, we are innocent. But we're not. I'm not. We need healing too. And to get that healing, we need to tell the whole truth. The good news is that we are having a more truthful conversation about racism in our culture. The general minister and president of the United Church of Christ recently stated that racism remains a wound at the heart of our nation that cannot be wished away or treated carelessly. We are theologically and spiritually compelled to seek the elimination of racism within ourselves, within the church, and within society. And the way to do that is to be honest about the racism within ourselves. For example, did you know that when our beloved state of Oregon became a state in 1859, it was the only state admitted to the Union whose constitution made it illegal for black people to live, work, or own property in the state. For the first 70 years of our state, it was illegal to be black in Oregon. The seeds of racism were planted in our very constitution. I never learned Oregon's racist history when I was in middle school or high school or even when I attended college here in Oregon. I only learned about it in the last few weeks. It's been swept under the rug. Of course, we don't live in 1859 anymore, do we? It's 2015. But I'm afraid that because we've swept Oregon's explicit racist past under the rug, we've also swept our implicit racist present under the rug. Oregon's racist past is evident in our present by the fact that Oregon has one of the lowest African American populations in the country, about 3%. I'm Facebook friends with one of my seminary professors who's an African American. After the Charleston shooting, he wrote a post to his white friends on Facebook that cut to the heart of the racial divide for me as a white man living in the United States. He said, "To all my white friends, if you live in your neighborhood, if you go to church, if you go shopping, and if you go to work and rarely see any black people, then you live in a white world that is constructed by the sin of racism and white privilege. You may think that white world is normal, but it isn't. It's sinful because it's based on the sin of exclusion." I don't know about you, but those prophetic words hit me hard because for me, they are true of my experience of white privilege in Oregon. Your life may be different, and I hope it is. So let me own this. I grew up in a white world in the suburb of Portland, and by and large, I live in a white world here in Eugene. Like the Southern Confederate flag of oppression, my white world is a sign of the racism and white privilege that infects me. And sometimes that truth is hard to hear. Like the bleeding woman, there was a certain fear and trembling when I realized the truth behind the words of my seminary professor. But then I read the passage from today, and I realized that what Jesus said to Jairus, he also says to us, "Do not fear." Why shouldn't we fear? Because white fear and white guilt aren't helpful. The truth about our past and present is helpful so that we can change our future. And the truth is that white America has benefited from systemic racism throughout our history that includes slavery, lynchings, Jim Crow segregation, racist economic and housing policies, and the modern Jim Crow of the prison industrial complex. So what are white people to do in the face of American racism that continues to divide our nation? There is hope. because there are things that we can do. One of the best things that we can do is seek friendships with African Americans as we share our lives together and walk hand in hand as we seek justice. We can listen to their stories without becoming defensive when we hear their truth about racism in America. We can read African American authors, particularly James Cone's book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, and Michelle Alexander's all-important book, The New Jim Crow. We can stop racist jokes and comments when we hear them. We can keep talking about how racism infects our culture. We can confront gentrification that benefits white people and pushes black people further to the margins. We can participate in political campaigns and vote in ways that confront racist policies of our past and of our present. We can claim that black lives matter because for too much of our history, we've claimed that black lives don't matter. And we can go online to watch African American pastors preach. When you go home today, I'd encourage you to look up Reverend Otis Moss III, the pastor at the historically African American Trinity UCC in Chicago, the largest UCC church in the US. Last Sunday, he preached on the Charleston tragedy. He talked about Chris Matthews, a white reporter for MSNBC. On his show, Matthews said he couldn't believe that after such a horrific tragedy, those families could forgive the man who killed their loved ones. In his sermon, Otis Moss replied that Chris Matthews couldn't believe that kind of forgiveness because Matthews had never been to a black church. And I tell you what, there's a lot that we can learn from that radical forgiveness. I'm still trying to understand such grace. Like the crowd that laughed at Jesus in total disbelief when he told Jairus his daughter wasn't dead but only sleeping and that he could raise her. Many are in disbelief about the forgiveness of those families. Many claim that it's cheap forgiveness, but there's nothing cheap about that forgiveness. What's cheap is a response to that forgiveness that is judgmental. As President Obama suggested in his eulogy on Friday, if that radical forgiveness doesn't change us, if that radical forgiveness doesn't break our hearts so that they grow bigger and more loving and more forgiving and in ways that make us seek greater justice and healing in the world, then our response is a refutation of that blessed forgiveness. Do not refute that forgiveness, that amazing grace. Instead, let us participate in it. And in all of these things that we can do, let us work together to follow in the spirit of Christ that breaks down the hostile barriers that divide us against one another. Let us heal that divide with the bridge of love that is called the kingdom of God. So may you go forth with the faith that God is healing the divisions within ourselves and within our world. May you go forth with the courage to face the truth about racism that continues to infect our world. And may you go forth with the love and forgiveness of God that breaks down every barrier of hostility and heals the divide with God's all-embracing love. Amen.